she heard every word I thought, because it is the way of all divinely commissioned beings. They know everything that can be known about us. She rose up into the air and positioned herself horizontally over my body. She never touched me, even though her face was no more than a foot away from mine. She was close enough that I could see the small veins and pores of her skin. Her clothing and hair were not responsive to gravity, but were falling toward her feet, the same as when she was standing. She had a most pleasant look on her face. I found myself closing my eyes and luxuriating in the absence of pain and sickness. I became aware that she was taking something away from me, probably my physical symptoms of pain, and by doing so, she was clearing my mind for the message she was commissioned to deliver. I suddenly remembered my visit with Jesus Christ in the parking lot with great clarity. I felt all of those things again. I saw His face and felt His love, and I remembered how I felt when He spoke my name. All of those details came back into my mind. I suddenly understood the vision I had in Tahiti with a totally new understanding. I saw the experiences in the clinic when I had died from the X-ray contrast, all with a new understanding and a new clarity. What I had remembered most clearly from those experiences was what my five senses had recorded. She was allowing or enabling me to see them again from the eternal perspective I had once had when I first experienced them. I had not forgotten those events, but had shifted my understanding in the last 26 years to accommodate what I thought was my impending death. She was not only allowing me to recall the events, but to understand once again the deeper meanings within them, and that their promises and prophecy were still true. You are not going to die. I had been playing this message in my mind over and over. I am dying, soon. I was troubled that my life was about over, and my mission, as I had seen it in vision, had not yet happened. I learned from this beautiful unnamed angel that I still had many things to do, and all that I had seen before was written by God into my mortal journey. All of it would happen. This was her message to me: you are not going to die at this time. She literally commanded me to stop thinking of myself as if I were dying. She stayed in that position, hovering over me for an indefinite length of time. It might have been seconds or hours, I just don't know. It was also the same message my apostle friend had tried to convey a few days before. Without the pain of my body to interfere, and with the deep peace of her presence, I fell asleep. When I next awoke, she was standing beside my bed, looking at me. She instructed me to write all of what I had just learned in my journal, and to remember it and never doubt it again. She said that whatever else I needed to learn and see to continue my preparations for my life's work would be coming to me shortly. She also communicated to me that my life was being preserved, not for my sake alone, but for the sake of others, those whom I was going to serve. I learned many years later that those people I would serve were her people. She said that I had been prepared from before the foundation of the earth for this mission, and that I should never again doubt that any earthly event, accident, illness, or even death could stop it from occurring. I'm not proud to admit that I did not have significant faith at that time to believe in the visions God had shown me, rather than believing my body, which I thought was quite obviously dying. It is hard, maybe inhumanly hard, to feel your body dying, shutting down, life draining out of you, and still have faith in long-ago promises of a seemingly now impossible future, but I should have. I should have just believed and rejected my body's attempts to die. Then my faith in God and my Savior would have raised me up. I am certain of that. Still, at that moment in my weakness and deep need, her message was profoundly comforting to me. She had come to arrest my decay, to set my thinking aright, to realign my feet with the true path of my life. She left the same way she came, out through the open bedroom door and down the hall. I never saw her again. I have thought about her many times and wondered who she was. My faith told me she was a long-ago progenitor of mine. These people who minister to us from beyond the veil are almost always family. When I see her again, I want to thank her and ask her name. I lay there for a while, totally exhausted and spent. My mind kept rehearsing the experience of her visitation over and over. I finally fell soundly asleep and did not awaken until late morning. I'm healed. I awoke with a bright memory of everything she had done, and my heart cried out, "I'm healed." but when I began to move, I realized my body was as sick as before. However, my attitude was no longer sick. I no longer thought like a sick person or contemplated death. I knew I was no longer dying and ceased to lie there just waiting to die, wishing it would hurry up. Her gift to me was that from then on, I fully expected to recover, and I began improving immediately. I was excited when I told my wife about the experiences of the night before. She did not receive it well, neither the message nor how it was delivered. She did not doubt what I told her. She just didn't know how to receive it. What I had forgotten, as deathly ill people do, was that she was suffering right along with me. I wasn't dying alone. I was taking a piece of her heart and her love and her peace with me. She had accepted the inevitability of my death and had actually been expecting it that very night. It was a process of grief that had torn away a piece of her soul, and she didn't know how to get it back just because of words. She didn't know how to go from hopelessness to joy that abruptly. Even when she believed my words and accepted the truth of what had happened, she had to wait a while for her mind and her heart to unknot themselves. I also think that some primal instinct was telling her not to expose herself to such hope, only to have it dashed to pieces in short order. When she saw that I was actually recovering, she began to rejoice with me. Chapter 5 Caves, Keys, and Callings. Three visitors. About a week later, I awoke in the morning with the impression that I was going to have three visitors that day. I liked having visitors because I was still recovering from the surgery and infection, and boredom was a problem at times. It also struck me in a comical way because Ebenezer Scrooge had been told that he would have three visitors too, and you know how that worked out. The first visitor was an older gentleman in our ward. He came and sat with me and read scriptures to me. He was kind to do this, but he stayed 2 hours, which left me quite tired. I slept for a long time after he left. The second visitor came at about 5:30 that evening. This was a brother from our ward who had just dropped by on his way home from work. He said he felt impressed to come talk with me. He stayed an hour and said that he felt impressed by the Spirit to tell me a few things. The first was that I could be healed and that I needed to work on obtaining the faith to be healed. The second thing was that I had many things to do before I died. These two things struck me as interesting. I believed he was inspired to tell me those things because I knew that at some point I would be healed. I had seen it in vision several times. I had seen myself in a body free of disease and doing much more, but on a greater scope than he was implying. I felt like I did have the faith to obtain that blessing already, and was moving as quickly as I could to obtain it. I didn't tell him that just a week ago, an angel came into my bedroom and reminded me of these promises and healed my mind of my "I'm going to die" thinking. I accepted his inspiration in bringing that message to me. It was another witness of what I already knew to be true. By the time he left, I was completely exhausted, and I was not looking forward to a third visitor, because the first two had exhausted me without leaving me something I could truly use to upgrade my endurance or change my circumstances. I wasn't feeling critical or ungrateful for their kindness, just tired. That same night, I couldn't sleep because of the unrelenting pain in my face and chest. I was no longer fearful of dying, but the surgeries in Mexico had left me in a tremendous amount of pain. Because of our financial condition, I could not afford prescription pain medication, and the only things I had were Tylenol and ibuprofen. They simply were not sufficient. The third visitor. My wife and I were watching the evening news in our bedroom. At about 10:15 p.m., I heard a loud knock at the front door, which was only a few feet from our bedroom door. I asked Lynn, "Did you hear someone knocking on the door?" She answered that she had not. She asked if she should go check the door. I realized in that moment that this was my third visitor and that I would have to go with them. I was actually thinking it was another person from my ward, and I'm not sure why I thought I would have to go anywhere. But I said, "No, don't answer it, please. I will have to go with them, and I'm just too tired." She gave me a sympathetic look, not because I was tired, but because she assumed I was hearing things now. She turned off the lights, kissed me, and rolled over to go to sleep. I couldn't sleep because my pain and exhaustion were so overwhelming. I know this sounds odd, but I was really too exhausted to sleep. I heard another series of knocks at the door. Whoever was at the door began knocking every few seconds over and over. I lay there thinking, if I get up, I will have to go with them. I finally began to realize that it might be an angel coming to take me from mortality. This was the ongoing war between my understanding of my physical condition and what the beautiful angel had so powerfully taught me, that I was not going to die. Up until now, my faith had been stronger than my thinking, but on this particular night, I found myself once again wavering. I chided myself and anchored my faith once again. I must have fallen asleep, because I awakened at 12:50 a.m. to someone knocking again on the front door. It was not an impatient knock, but just sounded like someone knocking. This time, I realized that the knocking was on our bedroom door, not the front door. I knew it was not one of the kids, because the knock was stronger and higher up on the door. The thought came to me again that maybe this was a part of dying, and I would have to go with them. I realized that I was soaking wet from perspiration from the few hours I had slept. I felt desperately ill, the kind of ill where you are too weak to raise your arm or to cry out for help. I had incredible pain in my chest again. Despite what the beautiful angel had told me, I knew I could not live much longer without a miracle, which I did expect, but had yet to receive. And still the knocking on my bedroom door continued to resound with intermittent and insistent knocking. I immediately left my body. I think my body was just too ill to keep my spirit within it anymore. I moved upward and out of my body to a sitting position on my bed. I looked back to my right and could see my face and shoulders propped up on a pillow. My face was pale with a look of pain, and my body was not breathing. I felt so grateful to be out of it. The pain had stopped, and I felt full of energy and vitality. You have to remember, I had died twice before, and this time the relief I immediately felt by being out of my body was almost like a drug. It infused me with euphoria and liberation. I was so grateful to be out of that sick, pain-racked body. I was rejoicing, and I felt far more than thrilled. I was jubilant, even though I fully expected to return to my body and live on to complete my mission. I could not doubt the angel's words, but for this moment, I was overwhelmed with gratitude to be pain-free, even for a while. I stood effortlessly and walked to the door to answer the knock. I looked back at my body, which was still lying in bed beside my wife. I felt connected to my body, as if a divine rubber band was connecting us. I knew that this was the spiritual assurance that I would be back. This was not death, but another chance to learn and see the things of God. My angel guide. I tried to open the door and could not. My hand passed through the doorknob, so I walked through it. I found myself facing a pleasant-looking male angel. He was an angel of light and had the full brightness of the other angels I had seen who had come to minister to the newly dead. But the instant I looked upon him, I knew that he had not come to take me from the earth. He was not the Grim Reaper, so to speak. He had been my guide on several other out-of-body experiences, so I recognized him even though I didn't know his name. It was a spiritual recognition. I trusted him and was ready and willing to go with him. The angel spoke to me verbally, not to my spirit as in other instances. He had a body and was not a spirit. I realized that I, now in my spirit self, was less substantial than he was. He held out his arm and said, "Are you ready to go?" I replied most gratefully, "Yes." Unlike the other angels who had just floated through walls and doors, he opened my front door by turning the knob and walked outside. It was daytime outside. It didn't even seem odd that in my bedroom it was a little before 1 a.m., and outside it was midday. What I concluded from this was that I was now in a vision, even though this felt real and tactile. The angel closed the door to my home. We walked down the front steps and started walking down the sidewalk. He was on my right, with his arm through mine. I could feel him and the warmth of his arm. It felt so good to walk again. I hadn't been on my feet for weeks and had been ill even longer. It felt marvelous to do all of this without pain or fatigue. I felt as if I could walk without effort for days. I felt exuberant to be with him, Like a little child who wanted to express his happiness by running, jumping, and laughing. I didn't, of course. I wanted to remain with him. I understood that he had something to teach me. We kept walking a long distance. We walked past businesses and houses. Cars passed us on the street, and people walked past us on the sidewalk. I am sure they couldn't see us because we stepped off of the walk to let them pass. It was a visionary experience, but it was realistic. There was a light breeze, and I saw that the breeze was blowing the angel's hair and affecting his clothes. I looked down at myself, and I realized that I was in my pajamas. I didn't feel awkward at all, but I noted that I could not feel the breeze, and it was not affecting me or my clothing. I thought, how strange. Here I am in the presence of an angel, and he's the one with the body, and I'm the spirit, and we're walking on foot up into the mountains. It was marvelous to me. I wanted to question him, but I felt like I should wait. I felt no labor or fatigue. I was walking effortlessly, which, for a deathly ill person, is like unexpectedly winning the lottery. Then the angel said to me, "The first thing we will see will explain to you why you are experiencing your life as it presently is." I replied, "Great! I would love to know the answer to that question." He was friendly and interested in me. My mind was spinning with questions, and I'm sure he was hearing all this. He smiled frequently as we walked in silence. I felt like he knew me better than I knew myself. He was completely engaged in this event of showing me what I needed to know. Even though we were not chatting as we went, I knew that there was purpose in everything he did. Caves and bars. We proceeded up a canyon I had been to many times. We walked a long way to where the paved road gave way to gravel. I could feel the road beneath my feet, but we were moving faster than walking speed, as if walking on a moving sidewalk at the airport. We arrived at the canyon quickly. The scene was familiar to me. I had been there many times on picnics and outings. As we stepped onto the gravel, the scene changed to a different set of blue-gray mountains with tall cliffs, facing me with three towering mountain peaks jutting into the sky above the cliffs. The sky changed to a more sunset hue even though it was midday. There was a stretch of water between where we stood and the mountain, as if we were on some island out on an inlet looking at the mainland. I could smell the ocean air and heard the waves breaking on the cliff face. I did not know where the vision was taking me. I was given to understand that I was now looking into the future, at what the purpose of my life would be. I concluded that I was seeing a type or a metaphor of the purpose of my life, not actual events that would happen just the way I was seeing them. But I also understood that the mission being suggested by this metaphor would actually happen, if not exactly as I was seeing it now. I began to see our surroundings through spiritual eyes, as the angel was seeing it. He asked me, "Do you see this mountain?" "Yes." "What do you see?" I walked closer. There were lights high up on the mountainside. Finally, I realized that they were coming from the mouths of four big man-made caverns. The caverns were about 12 feet tall, and about 150 feet wide at their opening. The openings had bars on them, as if they were prisons. The caves extended deep into the mountain, with doors leading beyond what I could see. The four caverns occupied most of the mountainside. I replied, "I see four large chambers cut into the mountain with bars on them. What does it mean?" He replied, "We need to come closer." The view changed instantly. I found myself standing right in front of the bars, on a wide ledge between the bars and the cliff face. We were high up the mountainside. There was a wide but steep road descending down to the valley below. I looked in and saw thousands of people in the chambers. There were rooms within for large groups, cooking areas, and massive gardens of flowers and vegetables. Deep into the cave I could see the closed doors along the back of the chambers. I assumed they were bedrooms, storage rooms, and other necessary accommodations. The people did not seem to see me, even though some of them were quite close, so that I could see them clearly. They were dressed well and going about their lives. They did not seem to consider themselves captives, but were healthy and happy. Children of all ages played and tended to chores. I watched them without understanding. Their whole circumstance seemed so improbable to me. "Who are these people, and why are they in here?" I asked. The angel pointed to locks on the bars. The locks were on the inside. They had locked themselves into the caverns, and the bars were of their own construction. "What does this mean?" I asked the angel. Why have they locked themselves in the mountain? He smiled and replied, That is right. These individuals have locked themselves away because of the persecution, abuses, and mistreatment they have endured from religious organizations and from the abuse of governments and the authority of the world. I perceived that this was both a good and a bad thing. They had isolated themselves from the world, but they had also isolated themselves from further light and truth. I asked, Why are you showing me this? What does it have to do with me? Then he showed me in vivid detail the pains and sufferings and abuses these people had endured while living on this earth. They had been persecuted and killed for generations before they found a way to separate themselves from the world. He said, Only individuals like you, who have been willing to undergo similar pain and abuses as these people have, will they ever listen to and trust. You must continue to drink of this bitter cup and not become bitter yourself. This will give you the experience and knowledge you need so that when you are called to work with these people, they will trust you and recognize in you that you are a fellow sufferer and refugee from persecution. These sufferings and your personal triumph over them will be written on your very soul and into the sinews of your body, and they will recognize it and trust you. Then he said something that I have pondered for years. He added, They will see that you also belong to the fellowship of the suffering of Christ. The key. While I was trying to understand all this, a young woman came toward us carrying a key in both hands. She did not look like the people within the caverns, but she was an angel of light, like my escort. She wore a long white glowing robe. She was beautiful and quite young. He took the key from her and handed it to me with both hands, with great reverence and care, as if it were precious and fragile. The young woman angel remained, watching me hold the key with great interest. I studied it for a moment, marveling at the beauty of the craftsmanship. I turned it in my hand several times, admiring it. It was unlike anything I had ever seen. The key was about a foot long, shaped like a modern key with a rounded handle and a shank with saw-like ridges on it and grooves along the side. It was heavy, as if made from solid metal, which looked and hefted like solid gold. The feel of the metal was soft, like velvet, not hard like gold. The handle was about 6 inches across, with precious gems infused into the metal. It appeared as if the jewels had been cast into the metal, because I could not feel them on the smooth surface of the key. But each stone was clearly visible and sparkling within the metal, as if the metal were transparent over the stones. Each gem seemed to have a tiny light source within it, which made the key sparkle like glitter with light that came from within the key rather than as a reflection of the sun. The pointed end was emerald green, the shank was blood red, and the handle was a vivid blue. It looked old, perhaps millions of years old, though it was not scratched, worn, or damaged. It was so intricate and beautiful that I thought of the Liahona, which had been crafted by God himself. I am certain that no human could have made this key. I noted that there were symbols on the key, which I could not read. The meaning of the symbols. What do the symbols on the key mean? My escort asked me. I immediately felt the meaning of the symbols enter my mind. The key itself represented a mission to rescue the people whom I could see on the other side of the bars. The key represented the ability to unlock the bars that kept them in their self-imposed prison. The colors represented the qualifications of whoever God sent to actually accomplish the work of unlocking the bars. The red stood for sacrifice, but not in the way that I had previously understood sacrifice. The knowledge I received included a full understanding of the condescension and atonement of Christ, but it also symbolized a willingness to likewise sacrifice as Christ has, to be prepared for this mission. In order to receive the key and the assignment it represented, one had to be prepared by sacrificing their will, their earthly possessions, their health if called upon, or even their lives if need be, to follow the path God ordained to prepare that person with charity, faith, doctrinal purity, sound understanding, and most of all, perfect obedience to God's will. This is the course Christ had submitted himself to, though his suffering was far greater and for all mankind. This lesser suffering we go through is to prepare an individual for their specific mission. It took me years to realize this is the reason the angel called it the fellowship of the suffering of Christ. I was given to understand that there was no other way and no other path to this type of service. It was a path that could require the shedding of blood and sacrifices of similar magnitude. When a servant of God followed this path to its end, it left a recognizable mark upon the servant, a glow, if you will, of righteousness. It was a preparation that made it impossible to fail, which those to whom he or she would minister would recognize and then follow. The blue handle represented the royal bloodline, which I immediately knew was the Latter-day Priesthood. We also have heard it called the Holy Priesthood after the order of the Son of God. The blue represented three things. First, the receipt and righteous magnification of the present priesthood. Second, it represented the receipt of the fullness of that same priesthood when worthiness and the timetable of God called it forth. Third, it represented a foreordination to this very mission to release these people. Only that specifically ordained officer of the priesthood could manipulate the key. The handle is how it is gripped and operated. The emerald green tip represented a renewal and recreation of life. The tip is the business end of the key. It enters the lock first, and it must be perfectly aligned with the lock in order for any other part of the key to operate. The green tip signified the full outcome of the red and the blue, sacrifice and priesthood, which, as described in the oath and covenant of the priesthood, brings about a renewal of the body. This is why the green tip was entitled Renewal and Recreation of Life. This renewal can represent anything from prolonged mortal life to a healing of all disease to being translated, as was John the Beloved and Enoch's city. It also represented the renewal that these individuals would pass through as they accepted Christ as their Savior and no longer were afraid of Him and those who represented Him. They must accept the ordinances of the gospel, which would allow each of them to be renewed and eventually set free from their present self-imposed imprisonment. The key in my vision is representative of the key every Latter-day Saint Builder of Zion will obtain for their specific mission. Each individual will probably not see an actual key being handed to them, but they will go through this same process that was shown to me of sacrifice, priesthood, and renewal. It took me many years, until just recently in fact, to fully identify the meaning of the parts of the key. Even knowing what the angel showed and taught me, it has taken my soul a long time to realize how it could actually come to pass for myself to make me into a builder of Zion. I have come to understand that in order to complete my life's mission, I had to receive this key in the ordained way by becoming a member of the Fellowship of the Suffering of Christ, and by doing it freely, willingly, even joyfully. I now understand that it is a personal journey of great consequence. It is not a pathway for seekers of comfort and casual service. I did not realize I was even upon this path, or that my suffering was a part of any path other than a process of my life. Nor had I ever considered that I was one of those whose premortal calling included any unique service until the angel handed me that key. This key represented the full course and calling of the priesthood. Only with all three of these elements can we claim the blessings and the honor of serving in any great cause. When we do this, we are no longer serving the church, our families, or even ourselves. We are serving Jesus Christ directly and doing the Father's work of preparing the world for the end of time and the return of Christ. Along with all of this information came the confirmation that what I was seeing was not real, but a metaphor to teach me why I was going through the hardships and suffering that have been such a big part of my mortal journey. I was being taught that all of my life I have been engaged in this process of preparing to meet the qualifications and attributes of one who will be handed a key to a portion of the latter-day work of building Zion. In this mighty work, we will free people from their self-imposed prisons, whether real or figurative, and bring them to Zion. The key did not represent a call to preside or to be a latter-day prophet. It represented the process of acquiring, through the atonement of Christ, the degree of personal purity and sanctification that qualifies the recipient to serve in this great work. It is a work that, as you'll see in future visions I will describe, is fully organized and carried out by the Latter-day Church. This is not a path that leads outside of the Church, or even on a parallel course with the Church, but one that brings you into the heart of the ordained mission of the Latter-day Church to prepare the world for the return of Christ. The only additional meaning I gained was to show me that I actually could accomplish this, that it really was possible, and that I should be seeking to complete my qualifications and then finish the work the Lord was showing me was mine to do. I should continue to accept that the process of my life was not taking me to physical death, but to the possibility of grand service in the latter-day scene. I felt this admonition enter my soul without words. Spencer, you are out of your body, but you are not dead. Don't give up, because these things need to be sealed into your heart and mind. These are the things you promised me you would do, so don't give up. I am giving you this information to bolster your courage to go forward and strive to accomplish these things. Don't be discouraged about going back into your body. Your body will not hinder you from your preparations. It was necessary to bring you here to give you a significant glimpse of the work you will do and to prepare you for what it will cost you to qualify to do it. This information entered my soul rich with love and empathy, but also with deep power. I knew it was not my angel escort speaking to me. I was just beginning to understand, standing there with this heavy key in my hands, when the angel said, "What do you see now?" Tunnel of Light. I looked around me and realized we were no longer before the chamber with bars, and I no longer held the key. We were in a tunnel of sorts, and I had the sensation of moving at great speed. I discerned that the tunnel was alive. Perhaps it would be more accurate to say it was part of my being. It was mine, and I had created it. My escort smiled again. "That is right. It is a portal, and you created it. Only you can use it." I thought about this, then asked, "So, does each person make their own portal before they come to this earth?" The tunnel felt like it was as much a part of me as my hand or foot. It was my understanding that this portal was how I came to earth to be born, and how I would return to God when I was at last finished with mortality. I could feel the tunnel, the same as one feels their arms or fingers. He seemed pleased. "Yes, that is correct. Everyone creates their own portal, which you now perceive as a tunnel of light, but which is just the best way for you to understand what is happening to you. It is a divine power you learned long ago, which enabled you to come to earth, and eventually to return to God. Everyone must create their own." We were moving without walking, but it felt normal and familiar. I knew exactly how to move forward in the tunnel. It was an act of my mind, like wanting your fingers to close around something. I did not need to touch the tunnel, because that was just how I perceived this form of travel, while still limited by mortal intelligence. I was moving at the speed of thought. The far end of the tunnel was profoundly bright. The light was not coming from the end of the tunnel, but from the tunnel itself, as if it grew more divine the farther from the earth it progressed. As soon as we entered the tunnel, or the portal, I felt less mortal, more empowered, and divine. I could speak to my guide verbally or by thought, and he answered me just by thought. We discussed many things as we proceeded through the tunnel. Every question I thought about, I saw that event or thing in perfect detail, including its creation, existence, and present glory. It was similar to when I walked through the desk and leather couch in my first experience. This information just entered my mind in bursts of understanding. I did not have to ponder or sort it out. I simply received the answers to my questions. My memory of this experience today is that we spoke of many things, and that I learned rapidly. I was not allowed to retain in my mortal mind most of what I learned. Folding the Universe. I asked, "Does the earth have a tunnel of light?" The scriptures inform us that the earth is an intelligent and living thing. He answered, "Yes. God provided a similar means for the movement of the earth to where it is now." I then experienced, as if I were actually there, how the earth fell from where it was created and moved to where it is positioned now. I had the impression that it took thousands of years for it to arrive. The image I saw appeared to me to be a folding of the universe. It looked like the universe was folded in on itself, like a sheet of thick paper or fabric, so that where the earth was created and where it was to go were on top of one another. The earth was then moved from where it emerged and physically transitioned to its new position. This moving of the earth occurred during the entire creative process. By the time it arrived, it was prepared for mortal man. I also saw that when it is time for it to return to its original location, the universe will again fold and the earth will be moved back to its place of creation. The image I saw revealed that even though we only perceive one plane of existence, there are an infinite number of planes stacked or layered in the same space. These planes are not truly universes, because they are less about infinite stars and suns and worlds, as they are about God's organization and the exaltation of all His creations, and His assigning unchanging glory and laws to each plane. Human language does not give us adequate words to describe such things, nor does human intelligence give us the ability to understand such things, unless our minds are open for a moment. While I was with the angel, I could understand all of this clearly. I believe I remember most of what I saw, yet now I only have a fragment of the understanding of what it meant or by what principle it occurred. What I learned then, and what I have been allowed to retain, has taken me many years to acquire the words to describe, even to myself. If you consider that this is the only time I have said many of these words out loud, you will understand why I still struggle for words. I did understand that the reason the universes were folded together was because it was more efficient. The word easier doesn't apply because God has all power, and nothing taxes His power or ability. It was just more efficient, and it is the way it has always been done. There is a celestial arithmetic about this vision that was amazing to behold. I realized that this mighty folding of the universe was not magic to God. It was more like brilliant spiritual technology. I saw that God possesses vast laws, principles, and science, if you will, of how to do these things within His understanding and power. They were beautiful to behold, like a divine dance with stars and planets as the performers. When men do math, there is always the infection of error and mistakes. God's arithmetic is always flawless, and I saw that the entirety of His creations were the recipient of His flawless godly engineering. All of the glorified universes I perceived were one of three glories, celestial, terrestrial, or telestial. There were other types, which were not types of glory. These were wonderful places without glory, where beings who had not qualified for a reward of glory during their lifetimes were ultimately sent. These were of every type, of every description, and were created in response to their desires. They wanted nothing more to do with God or His intervention in their lives, so He gave them what they wanted, whatever it was, and there they would stay throughout eternity, unable to challenge God's authority ever again. Our earth is presently of the telestial order, but before the era of man, the earth had come from a celestial plane. It was not yet celestialized, but it was created there. The transition from a celestial realm to the mortal world is what constituted the fall, and was accomplished by this folding process. When a person dies, or when they have an out-of-body experience, as in my case, their own tunnel brings them back to their original place and to their original structure, which were both spiritual in nature. This power to return to God is only perceived as a tunnel of light. It is not physical, and it is not actually a tunnel, but it is the sure way God has provided for our spirits to return to Him. When we are done with this celestial experience, we will no longer need this tunnel between earth and God. We will then be able, as spirits, and eventually as resurrected beings, to move instantly across vast distances by the power of God that will be inherent within us. We needed the tunnel of light, because a flawed mortal does not have the ability to initiate travel as does a spirit. Similar to leaving a rope dangling over the cliff so we can climb back up, we left the tunnel of light as our sure means of returning home after we have discarded this fleshy tabernacle. Meadow and Lake. I was pondering these things as we arrived at the end of the tunnel. I found myself standing in a beautiful meadow. There were fully grown trees nearby of many varieties. Some were in blossom, while others were heavy with fruit. A short distance away, a blue lake reflected the beautiful arrangement of trees and bushes beyond. There was no sun in the sky, and I understood that the light by which I perceived these things was from the Son of God, not the sun. I was aware that there were several varieties of fish in the lake, as well as many other varieties of plants, but no other animals. The meadow and lake were striking, with magnificent displays of flowers and flowering shrubs of many varieties. A narrow stream was flowing between myself and the lake, emptying into the lake a short distance away. Just to my right, I saw a decorative fence about 3 feet tall. It ran along the stream for a little ways, then off to my right. There were beautiful benches built into the wall every few yards. The wall curved in places so that the benches formed an alcove for people to sit, facing each other to converse. Initially, I just walked around looking at the wall. I had never seen such a thing before. The wall was made of bricks of white stone about a foot square. I sat along the wall on one of the benches and felt it welcome me, giving me love and praising God. Had I not experienced this aspect of spiritual communication and connectedness with all things in prior visions, I would have been startled. But I felt connected to everything I could see. In previous experiences of walking through desks and walls on earth, I had also understood the history of those things, every event of its existence. With these things, the wall and trees, there was no history, yet I understood that these things were almost eternal in their existence. This was a spiritual world, and nothing changed, nothing aged, nothing grew old or died, or was harvested and coerced by man into some other shape. So they were just as God had created them, no change, no history. I was waiting for my guide to catch up with me and show me where to go. He had arrived with me, but had not accompanied me to the meadow. I was not certain where to go without him, and I accepted that he was allowing me this interval to experience this place. I didn't know where I was, but I was also not concerned or worried. Everything was as it should be. I stood and walked to the end of the wall, stepped through the stream, and walked to the lake. The water in the stream and lake was crystal clear. I could easily see to the bottom of the lake, which I had never experienced in mortality because of reflection or impurities in the water. I could see fish swimming as if they were birds in the air. Everything was worshiping God and welcoming me. I walked to the edge of the water and knelt to dip my hands in it. It was cool, but when I withdrew my hand, it was not wet. I stood and put my toe on the water, not in, but on. I felt like I had done this before. I just knew I could. I stepped onto the water and walked out a dozen steps. I could look down all of the way to the bottom. It gave me a feeling of flying because the water was so clear. When I moved my feet, the water rippled just as water does on earth, but my foot was on a solid surface and not getting wet. I walked back to the shore and onto the grass, and this time I decided to walk into the water. I realized that walking into the water was something I had learned to do before. On earth, the natural response of water is to let you sink. Here, obviously, the natural response was to support you. I decided I would try again. I stepped into the water, pressing my toe a little deeper. The water came to my ankles, and I walked in a short circle, ankle deep in the water. When I again reached shore, I was still perfectly dry. I tried again, this time up to my knees, then again up to my waist. I realized that I was actually getting into the water as much as my belief allowed me to. I finally decided just to walk into the water until I was fully immersed. The water did not resist my desire, and I walked waist deep into the water. I could feel it, but I was not getting wet. I splashed a little on my clothing, and it ran off, leaving me dry. I walked deeper. I knew I was in the spirit, and my body was somewhere on earth, so I had no fear of drowning. Still, just before I stepped in over my head, I held my breath. I waited a long time before I realized that I was not experiencing a lack of oxygen. I slowly released my breath and saw no bubbles come from my mouth. I carefully inhaled and was breathing air, which I realized, or the understanding came to me, that I was remembering my body's need for oxygen. The spirit had no such need, and there was no air going in and out of my spirit, even though I had the sensation of breathing. I walked around the bottom of the lake for a while. There was no resistance to the water. I just walked as freely as on dry ground. The bottom of the lake was like a planted garden with beautiful floating plants and paths between them made of sand. I touched a few fishes, which did not scurry away but radiated their small love for me. When I was satisfied, I walked to the shore and emerged dry upon the grass. I looked back at the lake, quite amazed by the experience until I realized that this lake was not filled with H2O. It was water in a spirit state and had the appearance of mortal water, but few of the properties of water. The most profound aspect of this experience so far was that everything was praising God. It did not have a voice, like a human sound, but it communicated by its spirit, and by its connection with all things, its love of God. I also realized that the instant I arrived in this new place, everything knew me. It all knew and reverenced and respected the fact that I was after the image of God, and that I had come from a mortal body. It knew that I was a son of Adam, and it loved and respected me. I knew nothing of this place from any memory of mine, but I felt truly connected with it. All of these things, whether grass or stone or bricks in the wall, were pleased with their existence. They were content to be what they were. But it was also my realization that none of these things had a will. They were not capable of wanting to be anything else. This whole place and everything in it was aware, full of praise of God, but it did not have a personality, agency, or will to be anything else. As I have often noted, this is hard to describe. There are no powerful, passionate, explosively meaningful words to describe such things in any mortal language, so I admit to stumbling a little with this explanation. When you are in the Spirit, words are not necessary, and anything can be fully described by a single thought and understood in totality by anyone you address. I was fully aware that this whole meadow and everything I was experiencing was here because the will of God had organized them into this existence, into this form, into this place. It had been done for God's purposes and had remained unchanged longer than man had been in existence. They had heard the voice of God call them to assume this shape, and they still listened for His command. Their purpose was if they were constantly asking, "How can I serve you? How can I be of value to you? This is why I am here." Even the flowers, when I bent to touch them or smell them, were worshiping God and expressing joy in their beauty only because I thought to myself how glorious and beautiful they were, which expression they heard and understood. Of course, I did not assume to have any authority to change them and would not have attempted it under any circumstance. How could I improve upon something that is already perfect? Everything was at its highest level of life and vitality. When I stepped upon the grass, it was not damaged. It just received me and felt pleasure in my use of it. The colors were beautiful, distinct, and more brilliant than earth colors. There were colors which I do not believe the human eye can distinguish, but which, if I had to name, were mauves and pastels in stunning variety. I don't remember seeing animals other than the fish. This place was like a painting where the artist just wanted fish in the lake and chose to paint nothing else. It was not a reflection of mortality. It was a place God had created to be exactly what it was, to radiate beauty for the senses to behold. I was still looking at the lake when my guide returned. He asked me if I was ready to go with him now. Through all of my interactions with him and other angels, they always asked my permission to continue. Once I have given it, they often directed my attention or asked me questions, but it was always my choice to go, stay, or continue. I said, "Yes, I am ready now to continue." Spiritual Childhood. Instantly, we were in another place. I recognized it immediately. It was my home, where I had spent all of my spiritual childhood. The building before me was immense, stretching to my right and left as far as I could see. It consisted of many beautiful parts. There were majestic arches, tall walls, windows of every shape, stunning architecture, and glorious ornamentation. The structure was made of stone-like material, white in color, but more like pearl, with gold and silver streaks that seemed to be moving slowly around larger emerald veins, as if they had occurred in natural stone. Each block of stone was about as tall as a man. A long-ago memory arose in my mind of watching Father create it. It had come to its present form over a long period of time, though time was just the limited way my mind understood it. It was just a continuation of the eternal now in my memory. The building had taken shape with purpose. God wanted a room to teach me in, so the building had obeyed His desire. He loved columns and representations of the beauty of His earthly creations near the tops of the columns, along the ceiling and over the doors, and it had all obeyed. I realized that some rooms had been created to teach me my first lesson of things I would encounter on earth. Others had been shaped to allow me to see and touch objects to teach me, such as books, art, tools, and many other things needed to prepare me for earth life. It was less of a building than a divine place that had assumed the shape of an earthly building for my education. It could take any shape God conceived. It did not require work, workmanship, tools, or trades to change it. It simply flowed in joyful obedience into any shape he wished. My guide opened a large door that was made from a single piece of wood. There were no joints or seams, as if God had asked a single tree to assume the shape of this elaborate door. The wood was unpainted and beautifully carved with natural wonders from earth, flowers, animals, children, men, and women in loving moments. The room beyond was a familiar entryway. The whole of what I saw radiated a sense of vibrant excitement that I was back. The walls and columns were of the same divine stone as outside. The ceiling was vaulted, resting upon four fluted columns with light radiating from everything. The floor was darker, more like natural marble of a dark emerald green. There was a closed door to my right, a wide hallway directly before me, and another closed door to my left. My guide led me to the corridor before us. It was about 20 feet long and ended in an arched window that looked like pearl. It appeared to be fluid, with smoky white color shifting in it. As we approached it, it turned clear so that I could see through it. The large room beyond was again familiar to me. He looked at me and asked, "Do you know this place?" I said with tears of joy streaming down my face, "I'm back home." In my mind, I thought, "This is where I used to live before I was born." I knew I was back in the spirit world, where I grew up as a spirit child. Many sacred memories and scenes flowed through my mind of my spiritual childhood, which I choose not to relate here. I stood there for a long while, never entering but watching and remembering my past. My room. When I was satisfied and again ready to move on, my guide took me back to the entry and to the first door I had seen. The door opened for me as I approached. I recognized it as my room, almost like a bedroom for a mortal child, but there was no bed there. The room was about 20 feet square, with a high, flat ceiling. The walls and floors were of the same material as the foyer, but with slightly different colors, lending more toward blue and mauve. I loved this room, and I felt as if it was all mine. The only furniture in the room was a large, rounded top chest sitting in the middle of the floor. It was about 3 feet by 4 feet, with an arched lid and rounded corners. The top was a beautiful red with highlights of burnt orange. It was made of the same material as the rest of the home, but it was thinner and brightly colored. The sides of the chest were a vivid canary yellow. I knew that I had picked these colors and changed them often to suit my childhood whims. The lid could be opened, but there were no visible hinges. I stepped to it, and after walking around it, I glanced at my guide questioningly. He smiled, and I slowly raised the lid. The substance gave my mortal memory the message that it was heavy, but it felt feather-light as I opened it. Within were strange objects I had never seen in mortality. There were utensils of strange shapes and different sizes, white clothing, and tools that I had used. I knew exactly what each tool and object was for as I stood there in the spirit, but since returning to mortality, that information has not remained with me. I realized that I owned them, but also that such things were common to our premortal experiences. Still, their connection to me had been a part of my early experiences. I picked up each one, looked at it, and remembered what it was for. Every object in the chest was an achievement of mine. Each object represented an accomplishment, like a trophy of sorts, of a lesson learned, ordinations I had received, stages of development that I had achieved. These objects signified my worthiness and preparation to participate in the object of the lesson, not just in this world, but in the mortal world as well. These things were like certificates, authorizing me to actually do those things. Each ability and authority was gained by a long process of qualifying for and earning that authority. I had received these objects as tokens of lessons I had learned and qualifications I had achieved. Some of the objects were actual tools to assist me in that act. To my memory of these things, they seemed to me to be divine technology, objects empowered with power by God to allow and assist me in doing some necessary service or act, like the Liahona that assisted Lehi's family, or the Urim and Thummim that enabled seers to see the future. The white clothing was carefully folded and was sacred and ceremonial in nature. It was all a part of my matriculation to spiritual maturity. As I picked them up, the lesson learned, the process of learning, and the joy I felt in the achievement returned to me. I treasured each object with all my heart and pondered on them and then placed them carefully back in the chest. Nothing in the chest was a toy or whimsical object. Everything had deep, eternal meaning to me. Each object recognized me and was happy to see and interact with me. I felt no reason to hurry. My guide was watching me, smiling and enjoying my discoveries. It was as if I had an eternity to examine them. After handling them and understanding them, I remembered the nature of the room. I realized that I had possessed the ability to change the room into anything I needed. If I desired to read a book that belonged to mortality, like scripture or a scroll written by a mortal prophet, I simply desired it, and the room would change to provide that thing to me. It came in the setting it had been used, in a palace, a cave, or on a desk. This is how it appeared to me. I could touch it, pick it up, and read it. I could feel and even smell it. It was not the actual object summoned from some eternal storage vault, but a flawless spiritual recreation or representation of it. Each object was perfectly like the original, including all of the memories and history a spiritual individual could experience from the original object. If I wanted to see something large, such as the birth of Christ or the creation of the earth, that event would surround me. I could watch it and learn from it, interact with it, see the angels and divine beings who had enacted the original events. I could move around it and see it from every angle with perfect clarity and experience everything and everyone involved in the initial event. In short, it was magnificent, and it was the most perfect classroom in eternity, and all who desired it had one just like mine. I recalled as a child spending eternities in this room. Once again, there was no time in that world, and the concept of time, of linear existence, was difficult to comprehend then. The idea of change, aging, decay, and opposition were difficult concepts. It was like a jellyfish trying to understand automobiles. There were no comparable experiences in my childhood thus far, and I remember pondering all of these concepts of mortality. Saying I spent a lot of time in this room would be incorrect. I spent vast portions of eternity here. I never changed. The room never changed except as I desired. I never tired, felt hungry, or grew weary of learning. I was enthralled with all of it and did not desire to do anything else unless Father or some other need interrupted me. When I had a question, I didn't need to go to Father for the answer. The question formed in my mind, and the room changed to provide the things I needed to learn. My education was not random. It was programmed, sequential, and ordained. It was the same sequence of training all of Father's children experienced, though I was aware that not all of Father's children, my siblings, were curious about all things or pursued their education with such devotion or an intrigue as some of us did. Like a boy in a free candy store, I stayed in this room and interacted with these things for a long time, speaking as a mortal, until my heart was content. My guide waited for me, enjoying my enjoyment. When I was ready to go, I carefully folded everything back up and put it all back exactly where it had been. I slowly and reverently closed the chest and stood with my hands resting upon its smooth surface. It was a long goodbye for me. I felt both my own joy and the communion of those objects in the chest, all of which praised God, loved me, and longed for my return. As I walked back into the entryway, I suddenly remembered my eternal siblings, Mother and Father. I did not remember myself as being one of billions. I remembered uncountable siblings, all loved and loving, but I do not remember sharing Father and Mother with them. I only remember being individually and singularly loved and cherished. I remember Father well, his power and majesty, his face, his hands, his form, his touch, and tender care. Even today I remember playing with him, running my fingers through the soft hair on his arm, laughing with him, going to divine destinations, sampling future earthly delights, tasting new things, viewing divine events, watching galaxies and eternities flare into being under his hand. To my memory, I was the only one present at these times, though there may have been multitudes of us, each of us feeling individually shepherded through childhood. Most of my spiritual childhood was spent in his tender care, in his arms, in his lap, in his heart. I remembered Mother equally well while there in my premortal home. She was present in all of my memories then, but almost nothing of these memories returned to mortality with me. My heart remembers her equally powerful love and her